Welcome to the 11th episode of the Nonstop Podcast with Pooja. With me, I have Nancy. Hi, Nancy.
Hiya.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
No worries. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, I need to explain the personality that you are and that you're a lovely colleague that I work with. And there's a very special reason that I brought you on the podcast. So the podcast is for women and uplifting, you know, women who listen to the stories and for women to also believe that there are different kinds of genres and career paths and just personalities in life that we can relate to and also be inspired by. I was very inspired by you the minute I saw you.
Oh, thanks.
And I thought it was only fair to bring you on the podcast. So I'll let you introduce yourself a little bit.
Yep. Hi, everyone. I'm Nancy. I didn't actually write an introduction for myself, but I'm 33 years old. I am from Surrey, work in London. I am a chartered accountant. I've worked throughout my career over the last 10 years. I've worked in financial services. I'm currently in a business development financial services role where I pretty much am doing sales in the private funds and hedge fund world. I love sport, I love skiing, general fitness. I go to One Rebel in London. I'm a big family person. I have two sisters, I have a lovely nephew, and I have a nice boyfriend, Alex, as well. So yeah, big on family, friends, and I guess I also work quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a lovely thing to hear that you're so big on family. And that's very important, right? Because we don't speak about it enough. We're all about the hustle these days. But I also have to kickstart the conversation of the podcast with us by asking you the very question of, you said you're a chartered accountant, yeah? How did, in the world of, you know, Kardashians and glamour, and the world of like quick social media and validation and interactions, how did you want to be a chartered accountant and why did you choose that?
I remember I went to uni, so, well, when I went to uni, I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life and my career. Since I was quite young, I always wanted to have my own business, but that doesn't really mean much. You could have your own business doing anything, and I wasn't really too sure. So I did business development at uni, mainly because that was the general route I wanted to go down. And then only in my third year did I pick accounting specific modules, because I realized that to really understand business and to have a successful business that doesn't fail in the first few years, it's important that you understand the finances. So I thought, well, why the hell not? It's a great qualification to have. So after uni, I decided to go down the route of training for my ACCA, which was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. It taught me a lot about hard work, way more than college or uni did. The exams, I thought at the beginning you could just, I don't know, do a bit of last minute cramming revision, but actually you have to study and focus for months before each exam, and I really did learn that the hard way after failing a few exams to start with. So yeah, I thought it's something that will give me a, you know, start off my career. I didn't think I wanted to be an accountant forever. I did do accounting for a good 8 years, but then off the back of that, I moved into a sales role. But what's really helped me with this job is that I understand how to put together a set of accounts, and I understand fund accounting, which is the industry that I work in. So yeah, I'm glad I did it, but it was hard. Especially when I was in my early 20s and living in London, all my friends were going out having fun at the weekends, and a lot of the time I was either at college or studying on top of a full-time job. So there's a lot of sacrifice.
So you started off in the field of accounts, yeah? And you, I mean, it's very obvious from what you're saying, it is not everyone's cup of tea, mainly because of the strenuous hours that you have to put into it, or just the fact that it's not a subject that you can relate to a lot while studying. So what was your first steps of the career path? Like, what you said, you had a full-time job when you were studying. So what was the full-time job?
So the first job I had, and once again, I left uni and I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. I went and worked for a small to medium-sized London-based accounting firm called Wellers. I joined as a trainee accountant. I was one of, I think, about 10 grads that they take in each year. I I actually, this was a massive failure in my life, and I think it is important to highlight when you've had some failures, because it's what makes you the person you are today. So I was there for about a year and a half, and they put me on, you know, the college course, which we did a few days a week leading up to each exam. And I failed my first exam, not once, but twice. And a large part of that is because I was living in London for the first time. My colleagues and I saw college as a few days off work. And I thought that I could just cram, revise before each exam, because that's what I used to do when I was doing my GCSEs, my A-levels and university degree. However, yeah, I did some last minute revision and failed miserably. So I actually, the firm I was working for, they said, you need to have a pause for 6 months and then go back to college, because you're clearly not ready for the exams. And then I made the decision, I think a lot of it was, I was embarrassed. So I made the decision to go to a recruiter and see if I could get another job. And then I landed myself at a financial services firm called Langham Hall, who provide fund administration for investment funds. So they aren't a traditional accounting firm. They provide financial services. So I joined there. I started my ACCA again. And then I spent the next 3 to 4 years doing my exams whilst working full time. And yeah, it was really tough, because the job itself was long hours and a lot of hard work, and I was also learning at the time as well, so it was like doing your job but also not knowing what you're doing but trying to understand it, and then also studying at the weekends.
So how would you say, in terms of the accounting world, would plan out, like, for somebody who's listening to this and want to take into the career path of, say, wanting to be a chartered accountant?
Yeah,
I trained and I qualified to be a lawyer. I mean, of course, with the long hours and the sacrifices, I relate to the most. Of course, I mean, there must be an end destination to all of this, yeah. And it must be truly something you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. But you also ventured into something so incredible and very engaging and with a lot of people dynamic. Because in today's times and world, a lot depends on the business development, right?
Yeah.
And we're kind of like facing a lot of fronts, from social media to human engagement to facing a pandemic. A lot of dynamics keep changing in this world.
Yeah.
And I understand accounts and being a chartered accountant has very less to do with what you're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
So very briefly, how did you make the switch?
I think, first of all, putting my own career aside, a lot of people I've met in this industry who are in CFO roles, CEO, COO, investor relations, sales roles, all types of different career paths in this industry, a lot of them actually are chartered accountants already. It's a really good base, and a lot of it is just because you need to understand finances to be in a decision-making role in any organization to a certain extent. And it's, you know, when you're training, it's pretty tough, and you almost have to, I hate to say it, start from the bottom. You have to work really hard, and you have to understand how to juggle things, how to prioritize, to then work your way up the ladder. So it's even if you don't want to be an accountant your whole life and sit there producing sets of accounts, which I can guarantee you will not be doing when you're 60 years old if you train to be an accountant, it's a really, really good base for understanding business and for learning some of the core skills to get you further in your career. So yeah, I qualified as an accountant, and then my path in that particular role at my old company was to then start managing other training accountants who were producing work for a portfolio of clients. So that's the route I went down. And you kind of go after promotion and promotion, but I found that at the time it was just, you know, the more senior you get, the more people you're managing, and the further away you are from the actual work, it just becomes a problem-solving role. So I wasn't massively happy, but the one part of my job I did like was speaking to my clients, speaking to my team, going to industry events, conferences, networking. You know, if a law firm was hosting a breakfast seminar, I'd always put my hand up to go. I realized that the one part of my job that really made me feel alive was the people interaction side of things. And it also happened to be a time when they were looking for someone to join the business development team. The team was one person at the time. It wasn't a huge firm. And so I made the move into business development, which was, yeah, probably one of the best decisions I made, because although it also wasn't easy learning how to do sales, I felt like I was in control of my role rather than having other external influences in control. So yeah, there was the opportunity there. I'm quite a people person. I obviously understand the services that my company was selling. So I was just in a very good position to be able to then easily talk to external people about it.
That sounds lovely. And I also, I've always been intrigued by the fact that, you know, with business development, because now it's very out there, like Nancy does business development, right? So we've come to that part of the podcast where we established where you are at this moment. We work with the hedge fund services, and primarily when you work with services and industries such as this, mm-hmm. it's so niche to sell something, because with the whole business development facade of things, one would imagine that, okay, there's a product,
yeah.
and it's very hard and fast out there. You can touch it, feel it, mm-hmm. sense it. It's very tangible. And then you sell it. You know, in your spokes of work, it seems so invisible, right?
Yeah.
So how does business development with regards to a fund services work?
So it's very different, because whenever friends or family ask me what I do, it's quite hard to explain it in one sentence. So I usually just say financial services sales. But if you, when you say the word sales, you just think, okay, it's like selling a car, selling a, I don't know, a watch, or a, like you say, a tangible item, even selling a house or something. Whereas this is selling a long-term service. And we like to say in our team, it's more consultative sales. It's more problem solving. It's more, you know, there's a, for example, it could take over a year to win one piece of work, one piece of business with a new client. And rather than just saying, hi, we're Citco, this is what we can sell you, do you want it, this is the price, them asking a few questions and then agreeing and signing up to us, we have multiple meetings to understand what they want, first of all, and then a lot of meetings for us to show them what we can do for them. And then lots of meetings with demonstrations and meeting the team, providing responses to their questions, sometimes even to the point of producing countless documents to explain specifics. All of that before even getting to the point of them saying, yes, we want to work with you. And when we do win business here, it's, you know, it's a relationship that's over 10 years that we're going to have with them. So we're also, you know, it's not just one item that they've purchased, it's years and years and years of paying us fees. So it's a really important decision they're making, and it's something that we need to make sure we're doing to the best of our, you know, it's high standards, and we have to be selling the company in the best way that we can.
Yeah, and with your sales, you know, a lot of it goes behind not just the product, but also you have to upsell human resources, right? And talent search and all of this becomes a very vital role in what you're selling. I'm sure with a company, with a brand, there is a lot of like core values attached to it. And if I have to ask you to pitch, for instance, you know, in a very rapid way about what you would sell in terms of a financial service, what do you think people look out for the first instance? Of course, they know that they are buying services,
yeah,
from, say, human resources and, mm-hmm. you know, maintaining compliance and all of that,
yeah.
which involves work in a long span of time. It's not mm-hmm. just something that comes fair and square. It's done, yeah. it's over. So what would you kind of say in a first sales meeting to say a CEO or CFO that we do this and we continue to do this?
I think, and this is something we talk about a lot, we have many competitors that provide very similar services. They're very similar sizes to us. The actual day-to-day service that we can provide, lots of other people can do. So yes, obviously we explain that that's the service that we can provide, but what differentiates us from the others? What's our USP? And a large part of it is the word partnership. So we aren't just a service provider, we are one of their business partners. that are going to help them to do their job as well as they possibly can. And you know, all of our clients, they want to get bigger and bigger, and we can partner with them to help them scale. Without going into too many technicalities, for example, this business reinvests a hell of a lot of their profits in their own software and technology, which means that our clients can lean on that to make their own operations a lot more efficient, smoother, streamlined, so that they can focus on growing their business. So it's really important that we show them the value add rather than, yes, we can produce your quarterly accounting, yes, we can do the reporting to your investors. That's kind of like just half of it. We need to show that we can give them that extra value add that others can't. And in these meetings and interactions, it's really important that you build trust. It's very easy to have a glossy folder showing all the information that you can do, but how do you get that person to actually believe you and trust you? It's all about the people and being honest and reliable, listening to what they want, not just having a one-size-fits-all approach. So building that rapport and trust in the first instance is so important to then get them to understand the value add. Sorry, I feel like I've just rambled on about that.
No, but I think, I mean, there's never straightforward answers, right?
Yeah.
As lawyers and as accountants, we always say it depends, because it's the right answer. I would ask also, you know, just for those who are listening, what are some of the USP words that you use in sales, according to you?
Oh, I mean, it can vary amongst different industries and things that you're selling.
Yeah.
But I think people and like the people that are going to be working for you, because even if, I don't know, if I'm choosing a new phone provider, a network provider, I actually really care about the people, and whether it's a phone provider or if I'm buying a new car or clothes from a shop, it's about the people I'm interacting with. If there's a problem, is there someone I can pick up the phone to? Is there someone in a shop that I can go to and speak to? Am I going to get fobbed off by an automated response? So I think people is really important, and especially the industry I work in, financial services, it's all about humans. And our clients want to know that they have, if anything's going wrong, if they have any questions, they can pick up the phone and there's someone that knows who they are, understands their business, that they can speak to and problem solve with. So, and I think you can apply this to most industries. So I think people is really important. And I think flexibility, once again, it's not one size fits all. And I know this doesn't totally relate to every single product or service out there, but you can't, every single client is different. Every single person has different goals and objectives. So you can't make the assumption that they're going to want the exact same thing as someone else. So understanding what they need and being flexible and tailoring your service or the product that you're selling to them is really important. I could go on, there's a long list.
Sorry for putting you on the spot, but yeah, I mean, it's just fascinating to hear, because most often, you know, when we hear terminologies like a lawyer, an accountant, or a business developer, we just think it's so straightforward, right?
Yeah.
But then when you have to break down the narratives and then you go into the molecules of like understanding a business, you kind of like take back and you think, okay, so when you're pitching to a business, for example, a CEO, a psychological aspect of a CEO, you know, he has a lot going on, and you need to say something so accurate and so right within the time frame that you not only gain his attention, but you also kind of like sell what you're really going in for. So what do you feel when you talk to, I'm sure you work across all ages and all different kinds of industries, some probably newer minds, younger blood, but then there are also like very conventional people that you do work with who have very orthodox way of looking into not just accounts, but just like a whole view of business.
Yeah.
So what's the biggest thing that you would say that, you know, when you interact with somebody who's like, you know, a bit more conventional and has been in the business for a long time versus a more young mind, what do you think is the large question difference that they ask you?
I think it's something you could speak about for hours on end, but the main challenge in my job really is firstly understanding who the key decision maker is and understanding exactly what it is that person wants. once again, I keep saying it, but it's not one size fits all. The CEO of a business is going to want to hear different things and different levels of detail compared to the head of IT or the head of compliance. And it's really important when you're in a sales role to totally understand and adapt the way that you're communicating to the person. So, and it can even be as simple as when you're at a networking event and you're speaking to someone. Someone could come across as really closed off, a bit introverted. Maybe they're not as chatty. You change your approach with them. You're not as direct. You're not as intense. You're maybe not so loud. You try to ask them questions, make them feel comfortable and relaxed, rather than a personality that's really, really chatty and dynamic. You also then want to become dynamic and chatty to match their energy. That's similar with when you're having meetings with decision makers. If it's a CEO that's quite, you know, far on in their career, they've had way more experiences than me even, they may not be interested in the detail. They want to understand the high level, but they also want to understand, you know, what their money's going to be paying for, how they can trust us. They might have concerns over lots of different issues such as security or how we can help scale their business, you know, reputation. If I'm speaking to that CEO, that's, you know, I'd be focusing on those kind of things. Whereas if I'm speaking to a fund controller who's more junior, younger, probably similar age to me or younger than me, all they care about, it's not the only thing, but a large part of what they care about is their day job, because that's their task and that's what their performance is measured on. They need to know how we can help them with their day-to-day, the quality of work that's going to come through, who they're going to be speaking to on a daily basis, how we do our work, how we process it, the specifics when it comes to the technology and systems we use. So, you know, I would go into much more detail and talk about the specifics rather than the high level growth and aspirational stuff that I would talk to the CEO or COO about. So yeah, it's really hard. You can't go in with the same approach with any one person. It's really important, because if you do have just one approach, some people might like it and some people might hate it.
Yeah, and I also feel like I'm asking you very boxed questions, but I really have to dig deep and ask, what are these financial services that you're selling? If you have to say, because...
God, I don't want to call people.
No, but I think it's very important that we kind of like start also validating things that are necessary, and it's happening around the world, and it's not just, you know, glamorous to sound or hear. So what are these financial services and how do you help people?
Okay, so Citco, a very high level introduction to Citco. We're actually sitting in Citco's London office. It's a family-owned business, started in the 1940s. We're owned by the Smeets family, and we still are majority owned by them. We've now grown to over 13,000 people globally, and that's through totally organic growth. We have offices in over 50 countries. We actually have over 1,000 people purely working in IT-related roles. We reinvest, I think I mentioned it earlier, we reinvest a lot of our profits back into our own technology, which is one of our big selling points. And the actual services that we provide is what we would call fund administration to hedge funds and private markets funds. So private markets would cover real estate, private equity, venture capital, infrastructure and credit. And you're probably asking, what is fund administration? It's not the most glamorous role, but it's all of the financial reporting relating to an investment fund. So in layman's terms, a real estate fund manager is setting up a new fund for £1 billion, and they've got maybe 50 investors who have all invested their money into this £1 billion fund. And every quarter and at the end of every year, those investors need reports to show exactly what their investment is worth, what the money has been spent on, how much the assets, the real estate assets, have grown in value, the performance of the fund in general, performance of the market. They need all of that reporting, and that's something that a fund administrator will do. So we will work with the in-house investment team at the fund to produce quarterly reporting, which is a set of financial statements, but also an investor statement to show what their investment is worth and more specifics. And once again, it's all tailored to the client and what they want their investors to see. We also do then the end of year financial statements. We provide a few other additional services, such as Depository, which is a regulatory service. We have our own bank, which is, so we can provide a number of services within that bank, especially lending to the funds. That's only for our existing administration clients. We provide company secretarial and more jurisdictional based work. So I don't know, if a client has an entity in Madrid, we can provide the registered office and the company secretarial and director services. So it's all, that's very,
yeah, which
very
is what
level.
I do.
There you go. So it's a very high level, but there's a number of, we are, what we would like to say is the, we partner with them to provide their specialist support on their financial and administrative needs of the fund.
Well, that was very beautifully
I've
put.
I probably missed out this, a bit, so I hope none of my colleagues see this.
No, but I think it's very beautifully put, because I think that's so interesting, and today's time we're not kind of exposed to the unlimited possibilities that we can get into, especially with education. It's very severely backdated, and on most generic levels, if it's not IT or, you know, visual communication. So I have to ask you this very prominent question that I read on Reddit all the time, and I'm sure those who are listening until this point would also want to know: what's the difference between hedge funds and mutual funds and any other kind of funds? Because hedge funds is a very, like, if I may say so, a secret society kind of a situation. It's for the wealth and the wealthier, yeah? So
yeah, I mean, to be honest, all... When I used to look at what funds were, I used to think, oh, it's just what wealthy people invest their money in. But actually, the investors in all of the funds we work for are what we would call institutional or professional investors. And institutional investors are actually the likes of pension funds, which is actually where most of our pensions are invested in. So, for example, I don't know, I'm sure a lot of people have a pension with Aviva. Aviva have, first of all, their own funds, and they also invest a lot of their money in other funds, including hedge. And they might invest £1 billion into something, but that £1 billion is made up of thousands of people's pensions. Not necessarily all of our pension is in that one particular investment. It's spread amongst lots of different things, like stock markets and government bonds and stuff. But the actual investors aren't necessarily just like Joe Bloggs from down the street that's just inherited a few million quid. It's actually what we would call professional and institutional investors. And I'm going to be totally honest, I work more on the private market side, which is more closed-ended funds where they invest in real estate or private equity, venture capital, infrastructure and debt. The hedge side, which is actually very big for Citco, we're probably the biggest hedge fund administrator. That's more open-ended, traded more frequently. There's a lot more frequent reporting to investors. There's a lot more buying and selling of investments rather than closed-ended, which is where you've got an investor, a fund where it might be a 10-year fund. The investors put their money in at the beginning and they can only get their money out at the very end. They might get regular distributions throughout the life of the fund, but they can't just dip in and out and take the money when they feel like it. So yeah, that's a very high level difference between the two. But with hedge, I think it's seen as a secret society mainly because it's confusing and people don't totally get it. And a lot of the time there's a lot of language that, you know, someone that doesn't work in the industry just doesn't understand. And I personally also find that frustrating, because if I don't understand it and I work in the industry, how on earth is anyone else going to? And that's where, once again, it's really important to know your audience, know who you're talking to, and speak in layman's terms if you need to.
Yeah, and I mean, I have to wrap up this discussion because I am very intrigued to ask you this question when you very kindly differentiated what the private investments are versus the hedge funds are. So in terms of, you know, the financial trends, and we're in the epicenter of the universe where financial things really get going. We're sitting in London, and a lot of things revolve around because it's one of the most important economies of the world, and still will be for a foreseeable future, not just because of the history, but because of the investments that has been made for, you know, age old in London. So what would you say in terms of return on investments, you know, because I'm sure a lot of people listening to podcasts or just in general have businesses and they want to grow their money. Mm-hmm. And would you say hedge funds are the place where you can grow the money? Or would you say, you know, in a hypothetical sense, it depends, because hedge funds is collectively a fund created to diversify the portfolio, mm-hmm. and then you expect, you know, interim or annual returns, or would you face it that way?
I would actually say we've noticed that hedge funds are not performing as well as they used to, and actually there's more growth in private market funds. So in particular, we would say infrastructure and private credit funds. Infrastructure funds, obviously that's just investing in infrastructure assets, whether it's renewable oil and gas type assets, or, you know, a railway line, or I'm trying to think of like a basic infrastructure asset, something, anything that's infrastructure focused, that's doing very well. There are some areas of real estate that are doing very well. Real estate's obviously a bit of a funny area. The last few years have actually been really tough, but there are some pockets of opportunity there. In particular, you've got logistics and warehousing, for example. People have moved away from buying stuff from the high street and they're now buying online. And where do the likes of Amazon and Zara and all the other shops, where do they have their, so they might have a huge warehouse up north for a lot of their products, but then if they have customers buying stuff in London, they need warehouses just on the outskirts of London. They need places to store their lorries and whatever it is. So logistics, that's always doing really well. Private credit, that there's a lot of growth there. That's pretty much lending to all types of customers. So historically, banks have lent money to people, whereas actually you can get private credit funds where maybe it's a startup business or not so, you know, a customer that the bank wouldn't have the appetite for. There's private credit funds that are investing money, and there's a lot of growth there. But for just an individual person, where would you put your money? I mean, a lot of people don't have access to these types of funds. There's a lot of what we call retailization happening, which is where individuals can invest, you know, from a couple of grand upwards into a fund. You'd be called a retail investor. That's happening a lot in funds, and there's a lot of online platforms helping that. I think there's, is it crowdfunding and a few others, but we're going to see a lot more of that coming up because people want to have a slice of the action in these big funds that are performing well. But to be honest, I personally don't have any money apart from my pension, obviously. I don't have any personal money invested in any crowd funds. I always would say, actually, stocks and shares ISA, and speaking to wealth managers, the likes of St. James's Place, and they're obviously a big one, but there's smaller managers out there where you can regularly invest your money with them, and they then manage their own fund portfolio on your behalf. That's where I would recommend putting money, because ultimately, unless you're a professional that deals with investments on a daily basis, it's quite risky just going, oh, okay, hedge funds are doing well, I'm going to chuck all my money in there. You're better off going through a wealth manager who will know the risk and return.
Yeah, and I'm just so mesmerized by all of the world of financial doings and beings, and I have to thank you, Nancy. It has been wonderful. I've learned a lot. I've worked with Citco for 2 years now, And by majority, I've done a lot of legal work and secretarial work, and it's very little that we do. We are exposed to the business in itself, and I'm sure for those who are listening, had an absolutely interesting
I hope it
time
wasn't too boring.
listening to it. But of course, in my podcast, we also ended on a lighter note, and most of the women guests that come on the platform, known to me, unknown to me. Acquaintance or whatever, and I know as a woman in today's time we're kind of like centralized with men, and I don't feel that there are many bridges to fill, but of course we do draw our inspiration from somewhere, something, mm-hmm. some person, some book or some movie, and I ask this to all my guests: what is that one book that changed your life, and what's the one movie that you are attached to? So you would like to say yes?
You did ask me this before the podcast, but yeah. I've been trying to think yeah. desperately, because I wouldn't say that any one book or film or even person has changed my life. Just in terms of like role models in my life, yeah. I genuinely would say probably my parents and then different people along the way.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, in particular, women I've worked with yeah. from you know, a young age, they've been role models. You know, to name, well, there are a few clients that I've met that have been really supportive, colleagues. I also worked with a career coach a few years back. She was really helpful with my self-esteem and confidence, because as you can imagine, the finance industry is quite male dominant. I wouldn't say that there are as many barriers to the industry as there used to be, but I think it's also probably just not as attractive to women. You know, you've got certain industries that are more attractive to women and not so much for men. And I think in finance, it's a lot of people in suits. It's a lot of, it looks boring. It doesn't look particularly glamorous. And being in this environment, I really enjoy it. It's super dynamic. And there are some really empowering women that I come across. But yeah, it's important you find people around you that help build you up and support you and don't put you down. They encourage you. They give you opportunities and praise, and that's men and women, and there are lots of them out there. Sorry, I've just gone on a tangent again. But in terms of my favourite film, yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's a life changer, but my favourite film is Titanic. It was the first, I'd say, adult film that I watched as a kid, and I loved the whole romance side of it. It was obviously a tragedy. I think I really fancied I've forgotten his name. Leonardo DiCaprio. How have I forgotten his name? Yeah. And yeah, I just thought it was a great film. I thought Kate Winslet, Rose, in it was amazing. I loved all her outfits and I just wanted to be her. So that's my favourite film. And then I've got two books. One is, it's called The Alter Ego Effect by Todd Herman. It's not really, it's not a book. It's more of a kind of self-help guide. I actually was recommended by one of my old senior colleagues to read this during COVID when I had a bit of a wobble. I was kind of burnt out at work and I said, you know, I don't think I'm doing well enough in life. You know, where am I going? And she said, read this book because you need to build some resilience and realize, you know, build some confidence. So very high level, The Alter Ego Effect helps you to work, you know, to really look at yourself and understand your skills and weaknesses and create your work persona. So, you know, I am very friendly and kind with my friends and family outside of work, and I still want to be like that in business. But one of the risks of that is being maybe lacking in boundaries and saying yes to too many things. So it's creating an alter ego in business that's made up of all of my flaws, my great personality traits, negatives, and then also like building something that was going to work for my job. And then the other book is The Boy, the Mole, the Fox and the Horse, which is actually a children's book, but my godmother bought it for me also during COVID, and I'm sure lots of you listening to this podcast know the book anyway. They've also made a little film out of it as well, but the quotes in that, I read through it, and it was after a horrible breakup. And it actually just made me want to cry, a lot of the quotes. So things like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And the boy replies, kind. I know that sounds so silly, but actually, if you just go back to the basics, everyone should be kind in life. And there's a lot of people out there that aren't, but the majority of people are. And as long as you approach everything with kindness, I genuinely think that you're going to be okay in life. One of our greatest freedoms is how we react to things. That's something that I've really taken on board, because it's very easy to react quickly with emotions, with anger, with tears, with any types of words. But it's so important that you just stand back and have a think about it, because that's sometimes, everyone's going to have failure in life, it's how you respond to it. But yeah, there's lots of other quotes I could go on about, but I really like that book.
Well, Nancy, that was just so therapeutic for me to even hear. And like, I'm gonna pick up some of these books and read it myself. And so we've come to the end of the podcast. And thank you very, very much for giving me this podcast and the interview and the kindness, because I know you well and around here at the office. And I know if there's anything that you embellish yourself, it's kindness, and you radiate it. And lots of it. So, and I wish you nothing but kindness and good health and a lot of success in your life.
Thank you.
And thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.